The Tom Woods Show, episode 2288.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, social media is a pit of misinformation when it comes to the subject of guns. So what you need is my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Guns. Smashes all the myths and a lot of fun to read. Pick it up at wrongaboutguns.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Paul Gottfried is back with us today. He's got a brand new book we want to talk about, the Paleo Conservative Anthology. You will recall that Paul is editor of Chronicles Magazine, the magazine I have urged upon you folks in the past. He holds a PhD in history from Yale. He is professor emeritus at Elizabethtown College, author of many books, but today is our time to talk about his anthology. So, Paul, why don't we start with, even though I would guess 70% of people listening know what the term paleoconservative means, it might seem a little bit inside baseball to some people. So if you had to explain it or define it, how would you do that?
Yeah, the introductory essay, which I wrote, goes into a definition of paleoconservatism. And I begin by explaining what it's not. Paleoconservatives are not the original conservatives going back to the 1950s, the circle that was grouped around Bill Buckley and put out National Review. They are not entirely coextensive. They're not at all coextensive, certainly not temporally, with the conservatives of the interwar period. They are mostly a reaction against the neoconservative takeover of the conservative movement in the 1980s. And they managed to rally behind them a number of people who were distinguished representatives of an older conservatism, from, I suppose, from Murray Rothbard all the way over to Robert Nisbet, Russell Kirk, George Carey, and others, Forrest MacDonald, who become associated with the paleoconservatives as a resistance movement, originally as a resistance movement to the takeover of the conservative movement by neoconservatives. And the magazine that becomes closely associated with them, although it was not at the beginning, at its founding, was Chronicles Magazine, of which I'm now editor. And from the mid-1980s on, Chronicles is really the flagship of the paleoconservatives. In the 1990s, there's going to be an alliance between paleoconservatives and the more socially traditional libertarians who were part of the Mises Institute. And Lou Rockwell, Murray Rothbard, Hans Hermann Hoppe, and others were part of that period of alliance, which lasted a few years. Then they sort of broke up over what I think were differences that should not have caused the breakup that came. Paleoconservatism became more and more, one might say, of a marginal movement after the conservative establishment managed to put them in a marginal position. Chronicles magazine at one time, I'd been told, had close to 30,000 readers. Now we're down to about, we sell each month about 10,000. We only have about a little more than 5,000 subscribers. What is interesting, and I note this in my essay, both paleoconservatives and paleolibertarians will never be let back into the conservative establishment again after the rebellion in the 1980s and 1990s. And at one point when they were behind the presidential run of Pat Buchanan, the paleoconservative, paleolibertarian alliance really had the wind at their back. The paleolibertarians have done better since then because they've been able to sort of reconfigure themselves as a movement that is concerned primarily with Austrian economics, although it also touches other things, many old seminars and teaching and other activities for which they are known. But you don't see these people on Fox News. I doubt they're asked to write for the Wall Street Journal. So in a strange sort of way, the ban on them has continued. Although by now it doesn't make much sense. But I suppose it illustrates the ruthlessness of the conservative establishment. If you defy them, they never let you back into the club.
It's true. On the other hand, how would we classify a guy like Tucker Carlson? In the old days, like let's say 15 years ago when he was active, I would have thought of him as quirky, but still safe enough to be in the establishment. But Mm-hmm. People share with me some of his monologues from his show,
mm-hmm.
and they almost routinely bowl me over in how just devastatingly on point they are.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you.
Would you say that he is, even if he wouldn't want to associate with non-respectables like you and me, isn't he at least a close cousin?
Yeah, he is a close cousin, but he doesn't have too many paleo-conservatives or paleo-libertarians on his show. And most of the people whom he presents there, one obvious exception is our assistant editor at Chronicles, Pedro Gonzalez, who appears on his show with some regularity. But most of the people who are there are pretty mainline conservative types. I think one of the things that Tucker has done to protect himself is to express very conventional conservative establishment views, whether it's on civil rights, attacking the Confederacy, saying that America's about equality and we're all the same, everybody's the same as everybody else. Things I hope he doesn't believe, but which I think he says in order to neutralize or disarm some of his opposition. He does, however, take some very, very gutsy positions. I agree with you. His position on the war in Ukraine, I think, has caused him to be attacked now by Mark Levin, who I think went after him last week because he doesn't favor more aid to Ukrainians. And he has been absolutely relentless in the way he's going after the Black Power and establishment and the attacks on whites. But again, he doesn't do it, one might say, from a white nationalist position. He does this as a violation of America's promise of equality. So I think even when he's taking what seem to be very bold positions, he tries to protect himself by appealing to traditional liberal or even in some cases left of center principles.
Paul, you will be very surprised to learn that despite his appeal to those principles, this has not stopped his opponents from calling him a white nationalist.
I know. You're right.
That's the way the cookie crumbles in this day and age.
Yeah.
There's an essay in here by Pedro Gonzalez, as a matter of fact, on a figure named Sam Francis,
mm-hmm.
whom, of course, you knew well. I met him a couple of times, but he died in the mid, was it late 90s? Do you remember?
Right. Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, I was only getting into this in the mid 90s, and I saw him at a couple of conferences, but I read his newspaper column. He was a syndicated columnist, Sam Francis, which, as I say those words now, Paul, it seems almost unbelievable that somebody as hardcore as Sam Francis had a nationally syndicated column. I remember he got in some trouble with the Washington Times for a column or two,
mm-hmm.
but all the same, I read him regularly. And one thing I remember about him was his interest in James Burnham, and in particular in the managerial revolution and in the Machiavellians. So what exactly is it that a guy like Sam Francis draws from James Burnham that he thinks that we need to be aware of today?
I think I hastily agreed with you about his time. He died in 2005.
Oh, it was that late. Okay.
Yeah, I went to his funeral in Chattanooga at the time. Yeah, he had an aneurysm, which was fairly common in his family because there were other male members of his family had died from an aneurysm about the same age, and he was carried off by this. This is after he had managed to lose something like 120 pounds by eating a steady diet of meat. Nothing else.
Oh, wow. So he was a pioneer of that even then.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people must have thought he was crazy because today it's kind of grudgingly accepted that this seems to work and some people do it. But that must have been like somebody trying to homeschool in 1971.
It was. I mean, I remember seeing him at a party that was held by American conservative. He wouldn't eat anything except meat. He was kept looking for meat. I think he did eat fish as well, but he wouldn't touch even the vegetables. All he would eat, all he ate was meat or fish or chicken. I think what makes him so appealing to, especially to members, younger members of the populist right, is that he really didn't give a damn what the conservative establishment said about him. And that was true. He would always make fun of them. And he did it with tremendous verve and literary skill. And he had an inimitable style. I suppose this was also true of somebody like H.O. Mencken in an earlier time. And I think both Mencken and Sam had vulnerable personalities. In some ways, had fragile personalities. But they perhaps compensated for this by saying very bold things. And Sam was never intimidated by the conservative movement. I remember the utter contempt he expressed when Martin Luther King overnight went from being an arch-villain of the conservative movement to a Christian saint, to a brilliant spokesman for the right, and so forth. And we both wrote columns expressing disgust for this, but Sam's was so much better than mine. Sam and Murray Rothbard both wrote much better satire than I can. I think Tom is also much better than I am at this, but this was one of the qualities of Sam that I think has endeared him to the right-wing populist rebellion that is now taking place. Also, he did not appeal to lofty ideals or conservative values, is a term that I always use with a contemptuous smile on my face, because these, you know, these values keep changing. But Sam would always speak about interest, power. And that's what he shared with Burnham, right? And because Burnham was the great analyst of power politics and power and international relations, and Sam was sort of drawn to the same ideal. There is an essay in the anthology by Grant Havers in which he reminds the reader that Sam Francis absolutely detested my book on multiculturalism. One of the nastiest reviews he ever wrote was of my book, although we were close personal friends, because I dare to suggest that political elites believe their own junk and crap, and they believe the myths that they express.
This was one of the interesting things about Sam, was he was convinced that no one could be dumb enough to really be an egalitarian.
Right.
So this is just a power play. It can't possibly be sincere.
You know, I assume they're confused and they're in a delusional state. And one of the reasons they can stay in power is that the people they control are also suffering from the same delusions. And the point I used to make to Sam is, can anybody possibly believe in this multicultural junk, right? I mean, of course, it's become even more extreme in its sort of woke manifestation since his death in 2005. But I think his answer is, well, no, what the elites do is simply manipulate these symbols. They don't, they're too intelligent to believe this. But, you know, as I tell him, if I were looking for some ideology that would allow me to rule people, why would I think anything is dumb as wokeness? I mean, I've declared war on the white race, on the male gender. I mean, look at all the things that they're fighting against. I mean, they're nihilists. They're destroying civilization, and they want to control the very society they're destroying. So my only answer is, some of them actually believe this stuff.
I've just heard too many stories from people who work at woke companies who tell me, look, I interact with these people every day, and if they're faking this, then they deserve an Oscar, because it sure seems sincere to me.
Yeah. No, I have the same feeling that to some extent they buy into this stuff, and it's not just an act. And they're not consistent. I fully grant the inconsistency in their behavior, but then I point out that Henry VIII, who has many mistresses and kills his wives and so forth, may also have believed in Catholic doctrine. Right. I mean, he went to war toward the end of his life against Protestantism because he believed in the seven sacraments, believed in transubstantiation. So the fact that a person does not act consistently with his religious beliefs does not mean that person doesn't hold those beliefs. So I give the example of someone like Hillary Clinton or some of these woke people who behave inconsistently with their ideals. But, you know, I still think to some extent they do believe those ideals. They're not going to switch what they believe simply because it becomes expedient. They're not just opportunists. They've spent their lives pushing certain ideas, which I have to assume they believe.
Let's talk about the kinds of accusations that have been made against the paleos. It's so tiresome. It really is so tiresome even to have to talk about this.
Yeah.
Because almost all the people leveling these accusations are intellectual pygmies who have nothing of value to say, and most of whom now here's my own personal theory. I think maybe they won't admit it to themselves, but deep down, I believe that some of these people have a grudging, very grudging admiration for people who will stand up against the zeitgeist, will say things they know they will be demonized for, because they themselves know they would never have the guts to do that. Never in a million years. They have to be in the in crowd. They cannot be marginalized or on the sidelines. And yet you have these people who, at great financial and professional sacrifice, are willing to defy the conventional narratives. And I think there's something about that that makes some people crazy. But in any case, regardless of my theory on that, what are the kinds of things? I mean, I am very familiar with the claims that people in this camp are anti-Semites, which is the accusation that right-wingers like to make because they need to have their own racism. And so anti-Semitism, they love that. So they're anti-Semites and they are white nationalists. That's the most common. And you can say other things, neo-Confederate, which is an idiotic term nobody who's breathing should use. So what do you say to that? And of course, I did read your opening essay, so I kind of know what you say.
The real problem that conventional conservatives or people who are the part of the conservative establishment, I suppose like Rich Lowry, who's probably the most egregious example of that, the problem they have is paleoconservatives will tell you things that are not fashionable if they believe they are true. For instance, every day I have to sit down and hear, if I choose to listen to this channel, I have to listen on Fox News, that American blacks are being treated horribly by the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party does not want to give them charter schools, that the Democratic Party is responsible for crime and so forth in their neighborhoods. Well, my own interpretation of this is that the establishment conservatives have to be absolute idiots not to notice that about 95% of the blacks are voting for the Democratic Party. And obviously, they like the Democratic Party and they hate the Republican Party. So, you know, you're not going to win them over by saying that the Democratic Party is hurting them. What's more important to understand is why they are attached to the Democratic Party. And it's not because Republicans are really racist, but, you know, they see them as a white Christian party, which, because of the racial divide, is hostile to black people. And no matter how badly the Democratic Party treats them, they're happy to go ahead and vote for Lori Lightfoot or Alvin Bragg, you know, district attorney in New York and so forth. And my point is, why lie about this? This is reality. Or I'm engaging in some discussion with some of my friends on the right who say, well, you know, the early civil rights movement was great. It was conservative. And then at some point in the late 60s or 70s, it sort of goes off the rails, and I make an argument that many of the things that you deploy in the later movement were present in the early movement. And if you read Martin Luther King's statements about quotas in the mid-1960s, or you read statements they make about whites and the expressions of animosity toward the white race, those things come quite early in the civil rights movement. And by the late 1960s, the movement is quite radicalized. So it didn't all begin with, I don't know, Black Lives Matter or something like that. But there are certain questions I find that the conservative movement will not ask itself. It won't even allow you to consider, because this would move them too far away from polite people and respectable people whose friendship they seem to desire. I'm also amused, you know, when I turn on occasionally someone like Sean Hannity as a black person and say, or Steve Hilton was it, the blacks are running into the Republican Party. Well, they're not. But it's important to understand why they're not. And it may not be the fault of conservatives or Republicans, but you want to tell people the real reasons. And this goes on and on. I'm old enough also to have been struck by the low status to which Joe McCarthy was relegated, although he is a saint in the post-World War II conservative movement. Most of the people who found National Review were ardent McCarthyites. They were defending McCarthy against his enemies. By the 1980s, when the conservative movement became neocon, there were all these strong attacks on McCarthy. And of course, McCarthyism is used on Fox News now regularly to be something that was equivalent in its nefariousness to wokeness today. McCarthyism and wokeness are equally bad things. Now, of course, a lot of people are not as old as I am, so they don't remember how many times the conservative movement has changed. But paleoconservatives have long memories. And I think at the end of the day, if there's any conservatism that has influenced us, American conservatism, it's probably the 1930s conservatives, opponents of the welfare state, the ones who wanted to stay out of foreign wars and so forth. Those people probably have much more of an influence on paleoconservatives than the movement founded by William Buckley, you know, to fight the communists in the 1950s.
There's a book from a long time ago called What the Anti-Federalists Were For. And the thing about the anti-federalists is that, yes, they had objections to the Constitution, but they were not a monolith at all. I mean, and a lot of them were for paper money, but some weren't. And so you can draw some generalizations about them, but nevertheless, there's a variety of them. And I think in reading this book, A Paleoconservative Anthology, I'm kind of drawing the same conclusion about paleoconservatives, because you have some of them who are traditionalist Catholics, and they're looking at the world through that lens. And so there's certain issues that they would tend to prioritize. You have some people, especially the younger ones, who are kind of inclined in the direction of populism. But then you have some of the older folks who have always been wary of appeals to the people. Mm-hmm. And so given that there is a diversity of perspective here, can we nevertheless, even though I realize it's not an ideology really, and it's not a set of propositions, could you nevertheless give a somewhat pithy overview of what we could say, nevertheless, these people have in common and what their vision is?
Yeah, I think you're right, by the way, about the diversity of views or the range of views they find in the anthology. And when I put this together, I decided that I would not exclude certain people because they were saying things that contradicted what other people were saying. I mean, Steve Presser and Bill Watkins have very different views of the American regime or what it should be than the views expressed, for example, by Carl J. Engel, which sort of sounds almost Schmittian or the kind of thing that Sam Francis might have written. But I think what unites all of these people is a rejection both of the left and the conservative establishment. And I don't think they even distinguish between them. They say that, you know, that one is a more moderate version of the other, but the two of them are united in their worldviews and in many of their policies, and would rather cooperate with each other than let either paleoconservatives or paleolibertarians into their club. So I think there is this resistance to both the conservative establishment and to the left that unites them. I think there's also a view of human nature that is shared, that human nature is both fixed and to some extent sinful, you know, that people need instruction, traditional moral instruction. You cannot trust their instincts. And above all, you cannot trust the modern administrative state, which is going to make human nature even more corrupt if we allow them to take liberties, especially with our young. So there is a distrust of all three, the conservative establishment, the liberals, and the modern political order, and certainly educational establishment. Now, the question is there anything to which these people look back? And I think the relatively happy age for all, this would differ. As I point out, some people seem to like the old South. Others, like myself, would just be happy to go back to the 1950s if that were possible, which it's not. And of course, I think all of us agree you cannot go back at the end of the day, that whatever solution we find to contemporary problems will not be a return to the past. We can be instructed by the past. We can admire its great figures, and we should, but the future will look different. The question is, you know, how do we get a handle on the problems that we face today? The moral, cultural, social problems, the runaway state, the massive, perverse social engineering that goes on. And I think there's a recognition that neither the conservative movement nor the left really offer solutions.
Do you think, when we're dealing with the conservative movement and their talking heads, do you think this is a, let's see how Sam Francisian you are, Sam Franciscan, let's say, you are on this issue. So he didn't believe that left-wing egalitarians really believed what they were saying, that it was a, it was just a path to power. Because if you do argue those things, then the necessary consequence is a large administrative state in order to undo everybody's prejudices and bring about justice and so on and so forth. Well, likewise, we have in the conservative movement people who would die 1,000 deaths before being seen within 15 miles of a Pat Buchanan, or saying the wrong thing about whether it's, could be anything from Ukraine to Black Lives Matter to whatever. They just would never, ever say the wrong thing. Do you think this is a case of they genuinely believe that Buchanan is evil, and those are the correct positions we should take, and so the left does have kind of a point here? Or do you think these are positions they state publicly because, doggone it, they crave being on television? They want to be respectable. They want their names in lights. I mean, I know you can't pry your way into their brains, but what do you think's going on there?
I think both are happening depending on the individual. I think somebody like John Podoretz, just to pick one example, genuinely believes what he says. And we could say, well, what he believes is a lot of mush or something, but he honestly believes in neoconservatism, in a neoconservative worldview. He's a strong Zionist. He loves the civil rights movement, but think it was derailed 20 or 30 years ago or something like that. He is passionately opposed to what he sees as the dangerous, racist, anti-Semitic right, which is basically anybody to the right of himself. I mean, I would qualify, you would qualify by his definition, but I'm sure he believes those things. I have no reason to doubt that he believes them. On the other hand, my impression of people who stayed in the conservative establishment when the neocons took over in the 1980s, mid, late 1980s, is that most of them were utterly cynical. They were simply part of the conservative. They were cynical in the sense that they simply took over these views or tried to camouflage their real views. I think they were devoted, the same way Communist Party members were devoted to the Communist Party, to something called the conservative movement. And I met many of these people. They lived their entire lives. I said, go to conservative movement events, and they'd send their kids out of the Hillsdale or whatever was considered, you know, the conservative college du jour. And they tried to be fashionable conservatives. One day, Martin Luther King was the most vile womanizer and comp simp. The next day, he was next to Jesus Christ. He was a holy man and so forth. And a great conservative, whatever they had to believe, they believed. You could say they were cynical, but they also, their lives were so intertwined with the existence and evolution of the conservative movement that it would have been impossible for them to function socially, even morally, outside the movement. That's why in my book on Making Sense of the Right, I have a long comparison between the Communist Party and the conservative movement. But I think for a lot of these people, it's the same, you know. People who stay in the Communist Party after the Soviet Nazi Pact, well, I mean, did they really believe that England is a greater danger than the Nazi Germany? Well, whatever the Communist Party, no, they probably did not believe that, but they could not have imagined living outside the Communist Party because it provided a total identity. I think for a lot of conservatives whom I've known, this is the case, since neither you nor I has ever been, had that identity or been encased in the cocoon of the conservative movement or swaddled in it or something. Yeah, well, it's hard for us to imagine. But I've known many people, and you know, some of them are not bad people at all, but they could not imagine life outside the conservative movement. And I had a friend who died a few years ago, who was a colleague of mine, and his entire life was spent as a member of the conservative. I mean, he would buy whatever the conservative book club was selling. His radio was always turned on to whatever you were supposed to listen to at that hour, mostly Rush Limbaugh. But I don't think he was really cynical. He just would simply recite whatever the party line was on that day. So these conservatives did remind me as communists. There were some who were obviously opportunist. And somebody like Douglas Murray strikes me as a total opportunist. He was the head of the Henry Jackson neoconservative something club in England. Then he came to the United States. He's now part of the Murdoch Empire. He writes regularly for the New York Post, and it's always the same sort of stuff. So that, you know, he's somebody who's made a career out of being part of the conservative movement and will pretty much say what you're supposed to say. But I think there are people who genuinely believe what the movement tells them, not because it is necessarily cogent, but because the arguments are cogent, but because they identify so fully with the movement, which is really just an integral part of their lives.
Do you think there is any sign that, obviously they're never going to admit they were wrong, but that, let's say, the official conservative movement might slightly be moving in a direction that we might like? I'll just give you one example. I can't remember his name now because I need to and now I can't, but the new president of the Heritage Foundation seems to be better than anybody they would have considered in the past. He interviewed Jeff Deist, who is not a tame or timid guest.
Right.
I think he's been warning about the escalation in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What's happening there?
Well, you know, if you read the essay by David Azarad, which is the first in the book, David makes the observation, which I think is true, that paleoconservatives have usually been right. They are unmentionable. They are anathema. One only brings them up to associate them with Richard Spencer and white nationalism or some raging anti-Semitic movement. But they've been generally right. And the conservative establishment has been generally wrong in most of the positions that it's taken. And Azarot argues it's the conservative establishment is not going to embrace paleoconservatives because they've been the villains for so long. But what they can do is absorb paleoconservative positions. And I think this happens periodically. Sam Francis used to call it artificial negativity, that every now and then conservatives would attack other conservatives and sound like paleoconservatives. Then the next day, they go back to getting along again and sounding the same way. But I think one of the developments of the last few years is that the right has become populist. I mean, you can't deny this anymore. And somebody like Nikki Haley is almost a dinosaur, right? I mean, she sounds like George H.W. Bush returned to life or something, right? And she's even too much for the Wall Street Journal. Which is telling you something about Nikki. You know, they say she's, you know, too much of a retread, you know, of Rhino retread and so forth. So I think that the Heritage Foundation people probably read the handwriting on the wall. They have to do something to line up with the populist right. I think they're not going to go over to Donald Trump, but they will support DeSantis. The problem is that once DeSantis is taken over by the conservative establishment, it'll be different. It'll be different from what he is now, right? I mean, they're going to offer him support. They'll give him speech writers and tell him, you know, what he's supposed to say and offer him money and so forth. So what happens is that the conservative movement, even when it sounds populist, can co-opt. The problem is they are beholden to certain donors, you know, and their donor base, believe me, are not on the populist right. You know, they're more like the Koch family, the Murdoch family. They're going to have to work with these people who are giving them money while at the same time doing something to sound like the populist right and even occasionally like paleoconservatives.
Just to, again, help people situate this in their minds, in a way, where did the paleo movement come from? In that you yourself were involved in, I guess, what we would call the conservative movement for a while and mm-hmm. before there was a term paleoconservatism. Mm-hmm. So did you just become disillusioned and you found other people who were disillusioned and you said, okay, I guess we're the paleos? I mean, Pat Buchanan is a little bit of an exception because he was somehow part of, in a way, the establishment for some time. I mean, he was in a couple of White Houses. He was in the press corps.
Is it?
He was at least personally reasonably well-liked, but that's not the norm. But nevertheless, most of these people were doing things before 1990. So what happened to make them into a self-consciously distinctive movement?
Yeah, I deal with this in my essay, and I point out that most of the people who become associated with paleoconservatism, which would include Tom Fleming, Sam Francis, myself, were part of an older conservative, of the conservative movement that existed before the neoconservatives took over, but we were not in the forefront of the movement. We were sort of secondary or tertiary figures, right? I mean, you know, we'd be invited to speak at the Philadelphia Society or this. I only had, I think, one column in my life ever published in the Wall Street Journal. I doubt Sam Francis ever appeared there. And there were people who were part of the older luminaries of the older conservative movement who joined us, like Robert Nisbet was on our side and Russell Kirk, others came over. But we were not distinguished in the conservative movement. The same thing is true, I would argue, about the left. That for a long time, the left was Marxist or pro-communist, but it also contained these lunatics who are today make up the leadership of the woke left. But the lunatics were sort of kept apart. I mean, somebody like Foucault in France could be a pederast or anything. He was in the Communist Party, but they were not going to feature him as a leader of the party. So that with the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of traditional Marxist communism, what happens is these nutcases are going to come to the front and take over the left. Or somebody like Bernie Sanders starts out as a fairly conventional radical socialist. Today, he's a woke leftist. So what happens is the left itself has changed. And with the paleoconservatives, you have people who are not very important in the conservative movement, but who lead the protest against the neoconservatives when they come along. So it's what Sam Francis would call the circulation of elites. we were not the elite before, but we become the elites in the resistance movement. So I think that's the relationship. In my case, I was never that close to the conservative movement. I did attend some Philadelphia Society meetings. I also was on the editorial board of Telos, which came out of the Frankfurt School. And one of my teachers and my favorite teacher in graduate school was Herbert Marcuse. So I really did not go to Hillsdale. I was not a Russell Kirk supporter. And I could be attracted to some of the stuff I read in Murray Rothbard. I could be attracted to even some of the stuff that I read in the Frankfurt School. There were some conservatives whom I liked better than others. I think like Sam Francis, I was very drawn to James Burnham, although I thought most of his writings on the Cold War were entirely forgettable. And he's pretty extreme on that subject. But as an analyst of power relations and as a critic of liberalism, I thought he was a very insightful writer. I also liked Robert Nisbet. There was at least some of the stuff of Kirk I thought was okay. I did not really discover Murray Rothbard, whose historical writings I like a great deal, until the paleoconservative, paleolibertarian alliance was formed. Before that, I spoke to these conventional conservatives who thought Murray Rothbard was beyond the pale or something, because he wasn't a tough anti-communist, or he was soft on Khrushchev or something like that. But I only became acquainted with his writings after the paleoconservative, paleolibertarian alliance was formed.
And was that alliance formed mostly around the issue of foreign policy at the end of the Cold War, or was there more to it than that?
I think there was more to it than that. I mean, it sort of broke up unnecessarily over free trade, and I've written on this, and I think it was an entirely preventable breakup. But I think they generally agreed on immigration. Murray Rothbard was a unified figure, as I point out here in some of my other writings, because he sort of bridges the two camps. He was an economic libertarian who wrote a lot about libertarianism and so forth, but he was a social conservative when he was critical of immigration. And generally, his views on foreign policy were accepted by both sides. After he dies in 1995, I think there is a split that comes along because he did sort of bridge the two camps and provided some kind of unifying ideology.
Why should people read the anthology? Let's see if you've got an elevator pitch.
Well, I think that they should read the anthology in order to understand important thinkers in the conservative movement who were totally sidelined, whose writings were blacked out, were never reviewed in the Wall Street Journal. In my case, I have not been reviewed in National Review since Robert Nisbet wrote a review of my book, The Search for Historical Meaning, in July of 1986. This is some idea. The marginalization of the paleoconservatives has been total. I don't think it's quite as bad on the paleolibertarian side, because I think the Mises Institute has really provided them with a home and has conferences all over the place and puts out books and so forth. I think the paleoconservative camp has been more isolated, and we've had much less outreach. So that this is an attempt in some small way to compensate for these problems.
Well, you will get vastly, vastly, vastly more out of this book than if you were to buy, any of the books Sean Hannity has written over the years. That is a really, really... That is not much of a compliment, Paul. I should probably rephrase that, but I just mean that there is so much forgettable, stupid, platitude-written bits of nothingness that the official conservative movement has foisted on it, hapless Americans.
Right.
And then this thing comes along that's actually by people with some learning behind them and with some guts, I'll put it that way, to stand up against the established view of pretty much everything. And it will not probably have quite the audience that these other books get, but I'm going to try my little part here to urge people to check it out. It is a paleoconservative anthology, New Voices for an Old Tradition, and I'm linking to it on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/2288. Paul, is there anything else you want to add that my inadequacies as an interviewer prevented you from saying?
You are not inadequate as an interviewer.
Thank you.
One of the best interviewers whose interviewing I have benefited from.
Well, I'm glad I let you say an extra word here then, Paul.
It's true. You ask the right questions. You're extremely eloquent. I'm on many podcasts, and you are among the best interviewers.
Well, now, on the other hand, now you just compared me to other podcasters. That's like me comparing your book to Sean Hannity, but I still appreciate the sentiment.
No. Well, of course, you're miles ahead, you know, in front of most of them. By the way, on this point about forgettable stuff, I was listening to this lady a few weeks ago. Her name is something like Kat Timpf or something like that. She giggles on the Gutfeld program. And I'm sure, I think she brought out a book, which I'm sure became a bestseller. I find it remarkable how the most terrible books that are produced by Conservatism Incorporated make the bestseller list. The most interesting example, of course, is Jonah Goldberg's book, Liberal Fascism, which was atop the bestseller list for about 2 months after it came out. It's a terrible book. But, you know, if you have Fox News advertising your book every day, you're going to do pretty well.
Yeah. And I keep telling our people that say what you will about Conservatism, Inc., but they support each other.
Uh-huh.
Somebody comes out with a lousy book, everybody rallies around it. That person is interviewed by everybody. He's in the neocon publications. He's uh-huh. everywhere. And they're going to push that thing. Somebody releases a book in our camp and it's like crickets. Like there's nothing like that. They ruthlessly promote each other. Now, it's true, there are some rivalries within Conservatism, Inc., but there's a lot of, I mean, how else do you explain, as you say, how well these books do? You know, how else can you explain it? It is that they get massive amounts of coverage and publicity from this massive network that exists. And so when the general public flips through a book by a quote-unquote conservative, well, let's just say this is not Mexico sending its best. You know, these books.
So, that's correct.
Anyway, all right. Thanks so much, Paul. Again, I'm going to recommend people head over to tomwoods.com/2288, pick up a paleo conservative anthology. And thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free. And we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.